Hi everyone, my name is Jay Haridas. I'm one of the dev managers in the Windows Azure Storage team. And today I will go over how storage works, what are the different abstractions, a quick introduction to storage, and then go over some key concepts and best practices that will enable you to build scalable applications over cloud storage, and also some future directions. Before I start, I just want to get a feel for how many people out here are actively developing on Windows Azure Storage? So how many of them are aware of there's a Windows Azure Storage team blog which has most of our new releases and how things work and things like that, all the blogging sites? Okay, great. So that's one more thing. Maybe I should let you know that we blog a lot and there are quite a few articles, in fact, a few released today on some new features which I'll go over. So, yeah, I'll just quickly go over Windows Azure Storage, a very quick introduction as such, which would be sufficient enough for those who are new to Windows Azure Storage. There's also, in terms of how to start developing, our Windows Azure portal site has a lot of how to get started examples that you can have a look and start building your applications. I'll go over what is new, what we've released over the last few days, and also some key concepts and best practices. These are very valuable in terms of building scalable solutions on Windows Azure Storage. And then I'll end off with some of the future directions in some key areas. I'll also take questions at the end, just in the interest of time. Jeff out here, who's a program manager in the Windows Azure Storage team, is out here too, and both of us will try to answer all your questions. So, Windows Azure Storage, it's a cloud storage system where you can store your data and you can access it from anywhere at any time. It's highly durable, available, and scalable. And we achieve this by storing multiple replicas of your data, and we make it highly available because the way we store these multiple replicas, we can tolerate certain common failures like disk failures or hardware failures or switch failures. In addition, it is massively scalable because we have an auto load balancing system which will understand your traffic patterns and then load balance to meet your traffic demand. With all these characteristics, it makes it very simple to start developing massively scalable internet scale applications on top of Windows Azure Storage. We have over 300 petabytes of raw storage, and it's still growing at a very fast pace. There are applications today that have been built on Windows Azure Storage that do 40,000 requests per second at peak. And so we do scale massively to kind of handle that sort of traffic pattern which you might want to see. This system is also very different from your conventional system, as in you pay as for what you use. In conventional systems, you would basically have this capacity planning and figure out what your peak traffic is going to be over the next few years and then subscribe for the hardware that can meet that peak traffic. Windows Azure Storage takes away that problem where you pay only for what you use. So if you're starting small, just to get a feel for it, you can start small and you pay for only the transactions and data that you store. And once you get used to it and the application is successful or your application needs to start scaling by storing more data, that's when you pay for that data, not from the day one where you have a plan in conventional systems. The interface that we provided for Windows Azure Storage is RESTful. It's well-documented and open REST API that we've given at MSDN site. In addition, we understand that not everyone wants to program in REST, so we've given some client libraries in various languages. All these languages are first-class citizens of Windows Azure. We have .NET, Java, Node.js. So cloud is truly language agnostic, and we truly believe that, and that's why they're first-class citizens. When you talk about storage, there are various abstractions that are appropriate for other various scenarios that you have. For example, when you want to start storing files, you can think of blobs as the abstraction that fits it. It's a simple interface where you can start storing files and associate metadata with your files. So for example, if you're an enterprise and you want to start storing your documents because you don't want to have this capacity planning for the next N years because you're going to grow into petabytes of data that you want to start storing, or because you want anywhere, anytime access and highly available access, you can think of moving the storage of your storage into Windows Azure Storage. In addition, social networking sites where you want to share your pictures or videos and allow your friends to comment on it, these sites have also been built on Windows Azure Storage. Big data analysis. This is almost every enterprise is interested in telemetry data. So you can think of big data analysis where you have this petabytes of raw storage where you can upload it into the cloud and then use the compute power in the cloud to do this big data analysis. Another common feature that has been built on top of Windows Azure Storage is backups. Backups of devices, backups of your computer. So because it's highly available and durable and anywhere, anytime access, you can think of storing these backups in Windows Azure Blob Storage. And then whenever you want to restore it, you can go and get your appropriate backup to restore your device. We provided a NoSQL solution. We truly believe that NoSQL is so prevalent in a massively scalable application in this industry, where most of where the industry is moving towards a NoSQL store, just because it scales, just because the paradigm has shifted from the back-end storage, like stored procs and joins and things like that, to a lot of logic in the client side, because you can make it scale to your demand. And so we provided Windows Azure Table, which is a NoSQL solution for your structured storage. You can think of storing, for example, your registration for your social networking site that you built, or user registration for your enterprise, things like that need to scale. You can think of storing that, including metadata. There are various key value lookup scenarios where you want fast access to a given key, and you can again start using Windows Azure Tables to start storing that structured data with it. In a distributed system, components need to interact with each other. You want to make the failures in one component not impact another component that is actually talking with it. So to kind of make it agnostic to failures, you use asynchronous messaging, and Windows Azure Queue just provides that. It's scalable, reliable, and persistent messaging system that we provide, where you can start to decouple your components. For example, your website that takes in a file, and then you have a worker role which might want to process the files. You can think of this being done through queue, where your website takes in the file and adds a queue message, stores the file in blob storage, and then your worker role goes ahead and is pulling this queue to go and process the file. So you've decoupled these two roles, per se. You can also think about building your workflows or process flows on top of Windows Azure Queues. For example, an order processing system where you can start updating the messages to say what state it needs to get into. And so you can have this process flow implemented on top of it. We have disks and drives, which are network-mounted durable drives. It's durable because it's based off a kind of a blob type called page blobs. It's fixed formatted VHDs based on page blobs, and this is used in the IIS scenario, and I'll go over more about it. So Windows Azure Blobs. So once you sign up for your account in the portal, you get three key endpoints, one for each of the basic abstractions, blobs, tables, and queues. For blobs, the endpoint is your account name .blob.co.windows.net. Once you have an account, you can start creating containers. Once you have these containers, you can start storing files in these containers. We have all the common APIs that one may need. For example, create container, delete container. You can set ACLs on your container to determine what permissions you want to share your container with. We obviously have put blobs and get blobs. The put blobs, we also have this efficient parallel upload and two-phase commit kind of blobs, and there's good enough documentation. I'm not going to go into very much detail about each API. In addition, we have set metadata, because you can associate metadata with your files. We've introduced a new copy blob command, which will allow you to copy between accounts. So you can think of this as an asynchronous copy, and this enables you to migrate accounts from one storage account into another. Snapshots is a read-only version, a point-in-time backup you can think of your blob. It's a read-only blob. So whenever you make changes to your blob and you want to store copies, you can think of creating snapshots. And whenever you want to revert back to a previous version, you can promote that snapshot back to your base blob by copying it. So this is kind of your versioning system, per se. Sharing scenarios. There are multiple sharing scenarios. Every kind of application needs different level of access. For example, in certain cases, you want your blogs to be public, for example. And so you can set your container containing all the blogs to be public, so anybody can access it. By default, everything is private, though. So by default, it's owner-only access, and it's secure. We also provide something called shared access signature, which is a hybrid kind of sharing scenarios, where you get to choose whom you want to share with. And so you create the shared access signature, and then you can give your shared access signatures to the folks whom you want access to. And this is just not read-only access. You can also give write access to others. So it's pre-signed URL as such. We always had leases on blobs, which could be used for your master election in a distributed system. For example, multiple instances of master may start and then try to acquire a lease on the blob. Whoever gets the lease is the master. And if the master crashes, the lease expires, and a new master can now acquire the lease and become the new master. So we always had the lease on the blob. We've introduced leases on containers now. These are delete leases. So if you don't want anyone to delete the container because you're still processing the files in it, you can acquire a lease on your container. In addition, we've introduced infinite leases, which is like a lock, which never expires. So there are scenarios where you just want complete access to it until the application decides to give up on the lease or the lock. The other change that we've done with leases is leases before was always for 60 seconds. Now we made it more granular. You can choose whether you want what duration you want your leases for, and the valid time range is 15 seconds to 60 seconds. So you can give this time range now for your leases. For Windows Azure Tables, it's the same concept. You have your account. The endpoint is table.core.windows.net. Once you have your account, you can start creating your tables. And entities is analogous to rows in a relational database system. The major difference from a conventional relational database system is the fact that your entities are schema-less. If you look at the first and the second entity in the blogs, the first one has a field called rating. The second one has a field called committed. It's truly schema-less. You don't have to give a schema or associate a schema with the table. The schema is in your application, is in your client logic. We've given one clustered index, which is partition key, row key. The combination of that gives you uniqueness for each entity. That's your clustered index. And those are fixed property names that you need to have for each entity. Other than those and the timestamp property, which provides you optimistic concurrency, the rest of the properties, you're free to decide what they need to be. As I mentioned before, it's a NoSQL structured storage system, which is schema-less, which means you can build massively scalable applications on top of it. The interface we provided for the raw protocol is OData protocol. So you can, if you're using .NET, you can use WCFDataServices.NET library to access your table data. In addition, we have the Java library and Node.js and all those libraries, but the .NET library just works with it too. We have the usual APIs like create tables, delete table, set ACLs. This ACLing permission is something very new that we've recently released. Before, table was owner-only access, and now we provided shared access signatures as we see below. In addition, we provide query capabilities. You can use your clustered index to get that single entity back very efficiently, or you can provide a filter to scan your entities and get the appropriate entities back again. Windows Azure Queue, the queue endpoint is queue.co.windows.net. Once you have an account, you can start creating your queues. And once you have the queue, you can start enqueuing messages into your queue. And you can store up to 64 kilobytes of messages, message size into each message. So you have, again, the usual suspects, create, delete, set ACLs queues. You can enqueue messages up to 64 KB in size. Each message can be up to 64 KB. Leasing mechanism is what differentiates this from your conventional queues. The way you process messages is you get the messages. When you get a message, you give it a visibility time. It doesn't delete the message from the service, but it just makes it invisible up until the lease time expires. So now your worker can go start processing these messages. And if it crashes before it can delete it, this message becomes visible again so that another worker which is polling this queue can get hold of that message and process it to its completion. So there's this leasing semantics that queues have, where you get this message, provide a visibility time, and then once you process it, you delete the message explicitly. There's also some key metadata that we provide with our queue APIs. One is called the message count. The message count allows you to auto-scale the number of worker processors you have. So you can look at your message count and then decide if you need more instances or reduce the number of instances. In addition, we provide dequeue count on each message, which tells you how many times this message has been dequeued from the queue. This allows you a lot of these poison message detection. For example, if this message cannot be processed by the worker because it was a bad, ill-formatted message, you can detect such messages by a dequeue count because the dequeue count keeps increasing. In addition, it may also give you a hint that maybe your visibility time is not sufficient enough. Sharing scenarios, like I said, it was owner-only access. We've released shared access signatures for queues. Why are shared access signatures really useful? Imagine you're developing applications on your devices like Windows Phone or iPhone or your favorite phone device or any device. Now, you don't want to give your key out to the device, but you want your application to communicate with your storage, either store a file or add a message or add some row into the table. You still want to give your applications this capability. And now shared access signatures can do that without needing a proxy service through which your applications would have to go through always to store data or access data. Instead, you will only have a service which will delegate or rather give out these shared access signatures to your applications running on these devices. So shared access signatures is something very useful where you can now start developing these applications for client devices at scale. So Windows Azure disks and drives. We understand that we need to make it very easy to move legacy applications to the cloud. Enterprises are not going to rewrite their applications. So their existing applications that are there, we wanted to move. And so we've released the IIS initiative over the last week, in which you can go and create your own virtual machine in the cloud. When you create this virtual machine, you associate an OS image with it. It can be a Windows Server, all Linux. In addition, you associate multiple data disks that you may want to access your data from. All these are stored as durable network drives, and they are all stored on page blobs. In addition, for the past scenario, we had Azure drives. These are basically drives that your application can dynamically mount in a worker or a web role. These are single volume VHDs that you can mount in your application. And then once you have these disks or drives, your legacy applications can just work using NTFS APIs. So you don't need to know the REST API as such. There are special drivers sitting in these roles that understand how to store into the blob storage. It uses a page blob. Each drive is a page blob. And the special driver would know what transactions to issue. So if you try to read some data using NTFS APIs, it would know how to go and read from this page blob. Similarly, writes. And it's durable. All flushed and unbuffered writes are made durable in this page blob. And transactions that have incurred to kind of do this writes and reads are basically accounted towards your storage account. As our blog suggests, there's a very good blog on billing and how we bill for transactions. So we have a lot of awesome features that we've released, and I didn't have enough space out here to list each one of them, but collectively, I call it the awesomeness. And to begin with, I really wish I could get such a price reduction on my mortgage. I wouldn't be here then. But 90% price reduction for your transactions. We heard you loud and clear. We've always said that Windows Azure Storage is built for scale. Scale means a lot of transactions, a lot of data, which means before you had to pay a lot more for this. So we understood that when you want to build scale applications, you will have a lot of transactions, and we've reduced the price now for transactions by 90%. What this means is, imagine you have a worker role which is pulling your queue messages every second of the day. You pay 0.8 cents for that entire day if you try to pull for a message every second. So that's what this reduction in price would do. So there's so we really heard your feedback, and this is one of the best things that has happened over the recent week. In addition, we've given you tiered pricing for storage. Again, we got your feedback. And so we introduce a tiered pricing. This is all on your website, on our website, windowsazure.com, pricing details. You can get more information out there. This is just a partial table that I've copied out here, so there's more information. Please refer to this site for more details. In addition to the price reduction, what we have introduced is two kinds of storage: locally redundant storage and geo-redundant storage. Locally redundant storage provides higher durability. We still store the three replicas in your local primary, and all the three replicas are written synchronously. So we do not return a success without storing all these three replicas locally. With respect to geo-redundant storage, in addition to the local three replicas, we asynchronously replicate your data, your request, to a geolocation which is 400 plus miles apart. So locally redundant storage allows you to deal with all the common failures which I started off my talk with, like disk or node failures or rack failures. All these things can be tolerated, because we have multiple replicas in the local tenant or in the local stamp as such. Geo-redundant storage, if you've chosen that, again, common failures. Because we have those local replicas, we still tolerate common failures. Major disasters where the data center goes down because of an earthquake or if it's demolished, whatever reason, fire. If your data center goes down in the locally redundant storage, we would contact the user to let him know that there is a possibility that there's data loss. However, if you have opted in for geo-redundant storage, your geo-replica can be used to get your applications back and running on the feed. Locally redundant storage comes at a cheaper price. Its price is 23 to 34% reduced from what you would pay for geo-redundant storage. Geo-redundant storage, the price remains the same. other than the pricing factor, if you want locally redundant storage, what you could do is now go to this new portal site for your storage account and then choose to turn off Geo. Geo is by default enabled when you create a storage account, so you can go to the portal and disable it. There are various reasons why you may choose to have local redundant storage. For example, if you have non-critical data that you don't mind losing on major disasters, local common failures, we still tolerate those, but major disasters, if you have this local data that that you can rebuild or restore, then you might choose for local redundant storage. In addition, there are various restrictions for other companies, other countries as to where your data can reside. Because we choose the secondary location, if the secondary geolocation is not in the country which kind of suits your application needs, then you can choose to turn off geo replication. We also release a new version of a REST API. The version is Feb 12, 2012. I think the documents are out today on this new version. What we have provided is a new copy blob API, which is asynchronous. And this allows you to migrate blobs between storage accounts or copy blobs between storage accounts asynchronously, where you queue up your copies. In addition, I spoke about leases. We have this infinite lease, which is like a lock in the distributed system, leases on container, and also granular lease times. Shared access signatures, we removed the 1 hour expiry time limit, and which was there if you had this irrevocable SAS. In addition, we have tables and queues that now support shared access signatures. So I quickly wanted to go and show some of the new things that the portal shows now for Windows Azure Storage. So once you go, and I have two storage accounts, let me just go to one of these. As you can see, there's analytics, storage analytics. We've given you a lot of this information on how you can use your storage and how you're using your storage and things like that and your metrics. Of how many calls were successful and things like that. Storage analytics was released last year, but the portal has recently added this in its site, so you can quickly go and have a look at how your system is doing. In addition, you can configure either geo-replication, where you can turn off geo-replication out here if you want locally redundant storage. And you can turn on your monitoring capabilities. So analytics for blobs, basically metrics, which gives you this aggregated details of how many requests did you have in that hour and things like that, you can turn it on. I've set the retention policy. Retention policy is to kind of delete the data after X days. You're not charged for the delete requests that are done. The system does it for you. It takes care of deleting all those data that you may not want, the old data that you don't want, the archival ones. In addition, we have logging, where every request that you make is logged into a blob storage. So this gives you this end-to-end tracing capabilities. So I would definitely suggest to you that every storage account you create, Geo is on by default, but analytics is not turned on. So I would really encourage you to go and turn on analytics, because this gives you the control to diagnose what's happening with your storage account and also learn about how you're using your storage accounts or how your applications are using storage accounts and make improvements in your applications. So I would definitely encourage you to turn it on and have this retention policy. Analytics is done in a separate namespace. Though the data is stored in your account, the storage analytics, it's done with using a different namespace, so it does not impact your live data as such, your business data. So the analytics data is in a separate namespace. In addition, it does not account in for the 100 terabyte limit that we have per storage account. So I would definitely encourage you to turn this on. So moving on to key concepts, every object that is stored in Windows Azure Storage has something called the partition key. I mentioned that our system automatically load balances your data into different partitions to meet the traffic demand. So the way we do this is with something called the partition key. The partition key defines what a partition is. Every object has a different partition key. For example, for blobs, it is account name, container name, and blob name. For tables, it is account name, table name, and the property called partition key. For queues, it is account name and queue name. In addition to the partition key, every object has a clustered index or uniqueness key. For blobs, it is account name, container name, blob name, which is the partition key. In addition, you have the snapshot time, or the version time, basically. For tables, in addition to the partition key, account name, table name, and the partition key field, you also have this field called row key, which forms the uniqueness key, or the clustered index. For queues, it is account name, queue name, message visibility time, and message ID. You control message visibility time, because when you enqueue, you can give a visibility time, or when you get a message, you can give a visibility time. You do not control the message ID. So how are objects stored in storage? They're all sorted by their key. The key is what is used to lexically sort it. It's lexical sorting, which means nine is actually greater than 10, if it's lexically sorted. If you really want 9 to be less than 10, which it is, you would have to prefix it with 0. So 0, 9 is now less than 10. So the lexical sorting is what it uses to kind of order your data. In addition, the prefix of the key is more important than the suffix for sorting. I have stored my log files in two different formats. In the table on the left, the suffix of the key, the blob names are timestamps, and I've suffixed it with basically ID, auto-generated IDs that I have. On the table on the right-hand side, I have made the auto-generated ID the prefix of the blob name. So what it gives is basically a sorting. In the first one, it's very efficient if I want to get all the blobs within a given timestamp. In the second one, it's very efficient if I want to get all the blobs of a given ID, because they're all clustered together. In addition, I said the prefix is more important, and that's why when the username changes, the last row, though its key is 001 with the old time, it comes in later because user 2 is greater than user 1. So the prefix of the key is more important in the sorting order. We have a range-based partitioning scheme. Usually, there are two kinds of partitioning schemes. One is the hash partitioning scheme, and one is range-based. We've opted for range-based because a common query is to kind of scan for locality of data. For example, get me list all the blobs in my container. Right? If I had used a hash partitioning scheme, every blob would randomly, in the same container, would be randomly spread across different partitions. So we use range-based partitioning scheme, and if someone really wants a hash based on it, they can provide their partition key as a hash of their actual value. So by providing range-based partitioning scheme, we have given the control to the users to use it as is if they are interested in queries, or use hash ID if they just want to distribute their traffic across different partitions for scale. So you have this both the options. The other important concept is all objects with the same partition key will be served by the same server. Note, I do not use the word store, but served. They are stored in the distributed file system, but they are served by a single server for transactional consistencies. The system automatically load balances these partitions based on traffic load. So assume that we have a single partition key, or rather partition field as such, and the key ranges from 000 through 9999. You can imagine that all this is being served by a single partition server. When your traffic starts to increase in this particular range, our system recognizes that and then would split that range into two and assign it to two different servers. So your throughput now has increased. Rather than the throughput of a single server, you now get throughput of two servers serving the same range, or rather different disjoint ranges, but the same basic range of 00 through 9999. So you have these two ranges now. If traffic continues to grow on the first range, our system again recognizes that and then splits it again. So now you have three ranges. And this is how we automatically load balance and split to make it scalable. What this also means is, to get the max throughput of our system, applications would have to dispute their requests across these different ranges. That's when you would get the max benefit out of our partitioning system. We are a multi-tenant system to offer storage at a very low price. We have to be a multi-tenant system. But we have certain isolation concepts in place. To enforce these isolation concepts, we have introduced some scalability targets. We have a single account scalability target, for example, 100 terabytes for a storage account. You can issue 5,000 objects per second per account, or 3 gigabits per second on a single account. Your partition, single partition target is 500 objects per second per partition, or 60 megabytes per second per partition. With respect to queries, small scans are efficient, whereas larger scans, we can return you continuation tokens so that you come back to get the remaining results. So you will have multiple round trips with respect to larger scans. Small scans also provide consistent performance. When you develop an application, one common factor that we've heard is, I want consistency in performance. So using smaller scans and being more diligent about how your data is stored is that knowledge is necessary to ensure that you have smaller scans. Moving on to best practices. With respect to your storage account, co-locate your storage account with the role or the compute role. If you're running within the cloud, co-locate those two together because egress is free within the same region. To achieve the scale that you need to, you may have to use multiple storage accounts in certain scenarios, like your scale exceeds that of a single account. Maybe you want to store more than 100 terabytes of data, or maybe you want more than 5,000 requests per second. For example, maybe you want 1 million requests per second. So you can now start creating multiple storage accounts. But store these storage accounts in close proximity with your clients. So if you are developing a site or an application that needs to cater to people living in different parts of the world, then you can think of creating accounts in different locations and then storing the data based on where your customer is residing. Rather than when you're building an application that caters to multiple clients, rather than using a storage account per client, it's easier for you to actually map that client to a container or a table name or a queue name. So you can use that differentiating factor, the container differentiating factor, to kind of isolate your clients rather than using the storage account as a single storage account per customer. It's easier to maintain. If your application really scales and you need multiple storage accounts, design upfront so that you can add more accounts at a later stage. There are two patterns that are generally used, and we will surely blog about some best practices around this, more prescriptive best practices around this, but there are two common themes of how you can add more storage accounts. One is consistent hashing, and the other is basically a lookup-based, where you have a simple hash lookup saying this customer is mapped to this account, and when you add a new account, you can easily map new customers to that new account. In consistent hashing, you might also have to kind of move. When you add a new storage account, you may have to migrate certain data and things like that. With lookup-based, you just start adding new accounts and use it for your new customers, because of which your scale may have increased. Windows Azure Diagnostics. If you're running in the cloud, there's Windows Azure Diagnostics, which gives you diagnostic information, perf counters for your roles that are running, web role or worker role. In addition, it gives you your own logging, where you can start logging information, errors, or verbose logs. Use a different account for this, because Windows Azure Diagnostics, unlike Storage Analytics, belongs to the same namespace as your account. It's not a different namespace. So any transactions or anything that your limits apply to your storage account would apply also to Windows Azure Diagnostics. And you generally want your diagnostics separate from your live account, which has your production data. So these two are isolated. I mentioned this before, I'm just mentioning it again. Choose local redundant storage if it's temporary data that you're dealing with, which can be recreated on major disasters, or if you have any constraints on location of our secondary data centers. So if you have any constraints on where you can replicate your data to, choose local redundant storage for it. Some common design and scalability aspects, the best practices around this, especially if you're using .NET, is set the connection limit, because .NET applications, by default, the connection limit is set to 2 for your web request per domain name. So you can set your connection limit to a higher. For all languages, we really prescribe turning off nagling and expect 100. So you can do this through .NET. I've provided, there's a Service Point Manager class in .NET which you can use to turn this off. And you need to do it right at the startup time, before the service points are created. You can turn off proxy detection when running in the cloud. When you're running in Azure Cloud, you can turn off proxy detection for your .NET applications through your .NET config. Distribute your requests across your logical namespace for your partition key values. I showed you an animation where the partitions kind of split and we have multiple partitions which are assigned to different servers. Strive for scalability reasons, for high scalability reasons, strive to distribute your requests across that range of partitions. For example, if you have users for your social networking site, if you want to have a user ID as your partition key, a GUID is a great user ID, or an email ID is great. These are all random with respect to how the user may use or may request your website for more data and things like that. That's a great random key to use as a partition key. However, avoid append-only patterns. Append or prepend patterns are where your requests follow a sorted order in access pattern. For example, the table which I had before is actually an append-only pattern, where I have the timestamp and a unique ID which keeps incrementing each time within a given timestamp. This is append-only because whenever I create a log, it's for that given time range which is moving forward, so it's logically sorted. In addition, even if the system splits this partition into multiple ones, you're always using the last partition because time is moving forward and you're always in that last partition that our system has split it into. So avoid append-only or prepend-only patterns for high-scale requirements. If your scale increases that of a single what a single partition can support, avoid this pattern. There are various one-time initialization things that you may want to do in your web role or a website or an application. For example, you may want to create your containers or tables that always have to be there for your application to work. Do this on startup of your application. You can do it once to ensure that they exist, rather than doing it every time a request is issued. This may seem very intuitive, but we've seen a lot of applications doing this where when the user is trying to upload the file, they're trying to recreate that container which should have been existing. So these are wasteful transactions. Yes, we've reduced the price of transactions, but you still want your application to be performant in terms of latency or how many round trips it has. The other common scenario that we've seen very often is setting ACLs on your containers, for example. You want to set your container to be publicly accessible. When you set your ACL, you can do this at startup rather than every request that you issue. For latency-sensitive scenarios, we suggest that you can use a caching layer to make sure that these objects are cached and they are rarely changing. Especially when they're rarely changing, you can just feed it off the cache and reduce the number of round trips that you may need. Use appropriate retry policies. It's a distributed system. Your request may fail because various intermittent network errors or whatever reason it may be, but use the retry policy. The storage client is already by default providing you an exponential retry. For blob design scalability, a common question that we hear is, how do I upload a single blob as fast as possible? I initially mentioned that we have this very efficient parallel upload mechanism. Our block blobs, basically you can use these block blobs, and in block blobs you can now issue these various blocks, upload these various blocks in parallel, and at the end commit the order of the blocks. So now you're getting this parallel upload for your file, where you can now now upload the content much more efficiently. The other common question, which is slightly different from the first one, is I have a container of blobs that I want to upload to the cloud. How can I do this as fast as possible? It's not a single blob. The first one is latency. The second one is throughput. You're more worried about how can you get your max throughput. So you want to upload multiple blobs as fast as possible. In this case, rather than using this parallel upload, you can use a single thread to upload each blob, but do it such that there multiple blobs are being loaded in parallel. Remember, the partition key for the blob is the blob name, basically account name, container name, and blob name. So if you want to upload all the blobs on your node, you can list various containers in parallel, each container in parallel, and then upload these blobs. This doesn't follow any sorting order of append-only pattern and things like that. So this gives you the best way of uploading as fast as possible. To migrate blobs between storage accounts, maybe you want to move from one region to another, you can use now this asynchronous copy blob. Again, you can list various containers in your account in parallel, and for each container, each blob in those containers, you can now issue a copy blob command. We also have Windows Azure CDN, which you can use to distribute your content worldwide very efficiently. So in Windows Azure CDN, what you could do is enable it through the portal. You can go and enable CDN for your storage account. You get a different namespace, different endpoint, basically. And you can use that endpoint to access your data or your files through CDN. Remember to set the appropriate cache control on your blobs, though. One of the things that we will be taking care of is to accommodate this append and prepend pattern just for blobs, for blob writes. Today, we recommend you not to use the append prepend pattern, especially for high scale scenarios. We want to resolve this issue, and this will be a future work item for us. With respect to table, it is a NoSQL storage, structured storage system. In a NoSQL structured storage system, the paradigm has shifted. Rather than thinking about stored procedures and joins and things like that in your database world, you think about how your client can shape your data efficiently so that it can access it at high scale. The design process, however, for designing your schema remains the same. Figure out what your important scenarios are, which are very latency sensitive. For these scenarios, figure out what queries you need. This defines your partition key and row key, because we've given you one clustered index for your critical scenarios that are latency sensitive. Use those scenarios to define your clustered index, your partition key and row key. In addition, there are various scenarios where you want these multiple rows to be updated in a transactional basis. For example, if you want to increment the, you want to add a new order into the system and also increment the order count for the customer. You want to do this in one transaction. The way you would do this is maybe select the partition key to be the customer ID so that now you can use an entity group transaction, which is a batch transaction, and it guarantees atomicity. So you can send your insert and update in just one single request to the service. I mentioned that our structured storage is a NoSQL store, which is schema-less, which means you can store multiple entities in the same table. This is what I meant by saying you can shape your data in an efficient manner. For example, if you want your blogs to be in table, associated with them are comments. You can think of storing your blogs and comments in the table, and depending on whether you want to retrieve efficiently the blog and its related comments, or retrieve all the blogs for a particular user, you can shape your data. You can choose the row key to be either the blog comment ID or the blog ID. There are various ways you can design this to make it very efficient. So you have that complete control on how you store your data, or how data is efficiently stored for your access. We have a single clustered index, which is two fields, partition key, row key. However, you can concatenate fields in whichever shape you want to get more, to kind of accommodate more scenarios. So you don't have to have your row key as your customer ID or a partition key as a customer ID. You could have it as customer ID and some other prevalent information that you need for your query scenario. So be aware of entity locality, and this is what the shape of your data matters. Be aware of your entity locality, because partition key, row key determines the sort order and how it is stored, because it's sorted, because it's a clustered index, they are sorted using this combination, and that's very important for efficiency in figuring out what your entity locality is. In addition, I said that all entities that have the same partition key are served by the same server, so you would want entities that you retrieve often or update often together to have the same partition key value. With respect to query performance, what determines performance is not the number of rows which are returned to you. It does impact. I mean, if you retrieve 1,000 rows, there is a cost you pay for the network transfer. But that's not just the only cost you pay. It's the number of rows that actually are iterated by the service that also impact your performance. So the order of performance is single entity lookups, where you give your partition key, row key, and get the entity back. They are the most efficient. They give you a consistent feel in terms of performance, and it's great for latency-sensitive scenarios. Small range scans can also be done, but you need to look out for continuation tokens, especially if your range scans tend to iterate over larger rows, so your large range scans. For those, you might have multiple round trips because we would have to iterate. We would have to iterate a lot more rows to get your query result. There are certain limitations in terms of, or rather, there are certain conditions in which we return continuation tokens. The partition range boundary, you remember we split the partitions into multiple ranges. If your query iteration hits any of the end of the partition range, we would return you a continuation token. In addition, we would return a continuation token after 5 seconds of processing. If your result set has 1,000 rows. So these are various conditions under which you might get a continuation token. If you're developing in .NET, one of the common things that we've seen is reusing of data service context or table service context. The data service context, the .NET WCF data service context, is not thread safe. So do not reuse it across logical operations. With respect to queue design and scalability, use your visibility time as a lease on the message, and you can use small lease times. When you get the message and you actually can predict how much time you're going to need for processing that message, you can go and update that message. So that would make, so in case your worker which has retrieved the message for whatever reason crashes before it can process it, the next worker can retrieve that message very fast. Make message processing idempotent. Because of the visibility time and the worker role may be processing the message, but before it deletes the message may crash, you need to make the message processing idempotent. Use batch gets. You can get 32 messages at a time. So use this to reduce the number of round trips that you have. Use message count to scale. I've already covered this. Use DQ count to detect poison messages. I've already covered this too. You can use update message to kind of store your intermittent state in your message processing so that no work goes waste in case your worker dies or a worker is restarted due to an upgrade or whatever the reason may be. So you start storing these intermittent states in your messages using update message. The message size is 64 kilobytes in size, so if you want to store larger than that, there are various scenarios where you may need to do that. The recommendation there is to store the message in the blob and then the message URL in the actual queue message. So you can use this indirection to kind of start processing it. To go beyond the scale of a single queue, you can now use multiple queues and randomly select, or rather a round robin, in a round robin fashion, you can go and start processing these messages and enqueuing them or dequeuing these messages out of them. Shared access signature. I went over various scenarios where you can use shared access signatures, especially with respect to devices. Use HTTPS when dealing with shared access signatures, either to communicate your URL, the pre-signed URL, with the users that you want to share it with, or when your users want to access your objects, recommend HTTPS so that your tokens, your shared access signature token, is secure. Use minimum permissions because you can give write permission, read permission, and things like that. Use the minimum set of permissions while using shared access signature and restrict the time period. The other common thing that we've seen while using shared access signatures is clock skew related problems. So you give a start time and an end time, and there is clock skew, right? It's a distributed system. There will be some clock skew. So to get rid of the problems which clock skew creates, what you could do is give a lot of leeway when you go and renew your shared access signatures, because these are time-bounded shared access signatures. There are two kinds of shared access signatures, one where the URL has all the parameters, the permissions, and all that stuff signed into it. The second is you can create a policy and store it on a container or a table or a queue, and then use that policy ID in the pre-signed URL. Storing this policy, or rather associating this policy with the container, is called revocable access, because If you want to revoke an access, you can just go and change that policy. So use revocable access, shared access signatures by storing by using these policy IDs. But there is a limit. You can only store 5 policies on a given container or table or a queue. When removing a given policy ID and recreating it, do not reuse the same ID because there might be a shared access signature that someone has with the older policy ID. So change those policy IDs whenever you want to recreate a new policy. Storage diagnostics, or storage analytics, which it's popularly called, it allows you to take control of diagnostics in your application, which is using storage. The other two applications that are really your friends are Wireshark and Fiddler. I will show a demo with using Fiddler as to how I can simulate various failures and things like that to test my application. So turn on analytics. I think I've repeated that quite a few times. Turn on analytics, logging, and metrics. You need them. You surely need them because we get so many support calls like, how many requests have I made on this particular day? This is easily available in your analytics metrics. So you have access to all that important information. So like I mentioned, analytics is stored in a different namespace, so it does not impact your account. You do pay for the capacity used by the analytics data itself, but you can set your retention policy appropriately. This enables you to learn from your application behavior and make certain changes in your application to make it more efficient. You can monitor your storage account usage. There's also an end-to-end tracing. So your web role or your worker role or your client on-premise application that is using storage, you can send something called the client request ID with each of your storage requests, and it gets logged in into storage logs, which is available to you. So now you can have this end-to-end tracing from your client application into what happened on the storage side. I gave you a demo of how you can enable analytics. It's pretty simple. You can just go to the portal, select your storage account, and enable it. Set the retention policy, though. One, I wanted to give a quick demo on how you can use storage analytics. I have this upload file where every web request that comes in with a file that needs to be uploaded to storage, I take that and start uploading it to a given container. And if I go to my analytics data, if I look at my availability for this particular hour, this is all my user requests for that particular hour, which I had, this guy. So I had about 101 requests. And if I look at, it gives me my average E2E latency and my server latency. Server latency is the time I spent on the server to process it. E2E latency includes the network time for your request. So this gives you important information whether there are some network-related issues on your client side or maybe in the intermittent network delays as such. But if you look at this particular hour, I see that this success, percentage success, is just 51%. When I dig deeper, I want to know which call I had various calls like put blob list containers and create container. If I go to, I want to know which call had suffered that. If I look at my list containers and put blob, I had 100% success, but create container had just two-person success. Where's that? Yeah. 2% of my calls actually succeeded. Ninety-8% of my calls failed with a client other error. This is expected errors. Client other errors, we've accumulated all these expected errors like bad requests and things like that into client other error, and that's the percentage of errors that I have. So if I look at my code now, the reason I had that was every upload file was creating this, getting this container and creating this container. And so every time I uploaded files, the 50 files I uploaded, every time it used to create this container which already existed, so it used to fail. The create container if not exists makes a request to figure out if the container exists, or it might send a create container, and if the create container fails, it's just going to ignore it. But that API call is still going to make a request over the wire to storage. So you pay in terms of the latency of this particular upload file method in my application. So what I've done is removed this, and as I said in the best practices, moved it to startup, so it's called only once. If I look at it, from there on, my number of calls reduced. On startup, it just calls it once, and it's not on every request that of put blob in the next hour, basically. So this is one of the samples. The other sample which I had was copy blob. So I wanted to move a blob from one storage account to another. And so I'm just going to debug this, and in addition, I'm going to also show how to use Fiddler. How many of them are actually, how many of you are familiar with Fiddler and you've used it consistently? Awesome. So maybe not show you how to use Fiddler because you already know that, but I want to show how I'm using Fiddler to kind of inject a failure in this. So I started my copy blob. I want to move the source blob, which belongs to a different account. I need to, when I move these blob, when I move a blob from one account to another, my destination blob, it goes, this request goes to my destination account service, which means this blob now either needs to be publicly available, the source blob, or I need to provide a shared access signature. I've decided to use a shared access signature. I've given it read permissions because all it needs is read, I'm copying it. And I've given it a 15-day access period. Before 2012 version, you could only give a 1 hour time period for your shared access signature. I get this token. If you get a snapshot of this token, you can access this blob for the next 15 days. I'm obviously going to delete the blob after the demo, but yeah, this is what you should not be doing, giving out your token to folks whom you don't want to give access to. You create your, I've created my destination account here. I've got the container name. The container already exists because I followed the best practice of moving my create container into my startup. I get the destination blob. I delete my destination blob if it exists because I'm creating a new copy of this. And that's not necessary, but I'm going to also let you know how I'm using analytics out here to debug. In addition, what I want to do with my destination blob is create an infinite lease on my blob before I start the copy. This is an asynchronous copy on my destination blob, which means that once the copy finishes, if someone else goes and overwrites that blob, it's no more the true copy that I had initiated. The copy would have successfully finished, but someone else has written on it. So I want to prevent that someone else from going and modifying my destination blob. So what I'll be doing is acquiring a lock on the blob so that nobody can write to it. To acquire a lock, that blob should exist. And that's why what I'm doing out here is creating a zero-length blob. Just a zero-length blob so I can acquire a lease on it Then I start the copy, and the system will now start copying it from the source blob and writing to the blob given the lease ID. And I'll show you how it does that. One analytics example that I wanted to give out here is putBlockList is a storage API in the client library, right? It has this normal retries. It'll retry on a failure. What I want to do with Fiddler here is introduce a failure. So I want it to succeed on the server side, but I want it to fail in my application. So I've set a breakpoint in Fiddler, which you can do easily using automatic breakpoints after responses, so that the call succeeds on the server, and then I have control as to what I want to return back to my application. Fiddler is the proxy out here for those who are new to Fiddler. The other thing I'm doing out here is I'm saying I've deleted the blob, so it should not exist. Create a zero-length blob with the access condition that it should not exist anymore. So there's in a distributed network, distributed system, there might be race conditions where I have deleted the blob, but somebody else is now writing to it or created the same blob. So to make sure that I'm not creating a zero-length blob and overwriting someone else's blob, I'm saying create the zero-length blob only if it does not exist. So that's the condition which I've given. I'm going to press F10 out here. In Fiddler, if you look at... if you look at this, it sent the if none match star, which is basically saying, do not create this blob if it already exists. Create it only if it does not. The call succeeded. This is the request ID. However, what I'm going to do in Fiddler is I'm going to simulate a failure that the service could not be reached. And I'm going to call run to completion. The storage client library automatically will retry this. And I'm going to shut off my breakpoints so that I don't need the breakpoints anymore. This time, I'm going to allow it to run to completion. It failed with 409. Remember, the previous call had succeeded. Now, because of an intermittent network error, I deleted the blob, I still got the blob exists. What I could do out here is, if it's a conflict, which means somebody else created the blob, or maybe my own retry created the blob, I want to make sure it's a zero-length blob, and then figure if I can continue or not. Obviously, I have very minimal code out here. I've just printed the exception out here. The thing which is out here is, through Fiddler, I've simulated this error. But when you're writing this application, there are various instances where your first retry may have actually succeeded on the server, but you got a failure because of which you retried, and then there was an application error because the entity already existed or the blob already existed. How do you debug this? Because especially when you expect no one else to be doing this, if this application was your single instance, no one else is running on this stuff, you still got this. How do you debug this? And this is where you use storage analytics, because now I can go to my log files. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes, but I have already run this, and I just wanted to show an example of where... if you go and look at this, I had a put block list followed by a put block list again. The put block list had succeeded. If you look at it, it's the same object. It's movies.wmv. So it's the same file that had succeeded, because of which my second call failed. So you can use storage analytics logs to go and kind of debug these instances which you did not expect, to see what happened on the server. Did my call actually reach the server? You can send the client request IDs and figure out if the client request ID is logged into your log file, and have this end-to-end tracing. And that's what I was saying. This enables the scenario of end-to-end tracing which we provided. So anyway, so that was about the stuff. I've gone ahead and acquired a lease, infinite lease on this blob, and then I can migrate my blob. I don't need this. Let me just minimize these things. Yeah. And then I can start my copy. The new storage client library, which is available on GitHub, we have links in our blog post. It's 171, so it's not available on the SDK download, but we've released the source code today, and it's available on GitHub. I'm using that. It has the start copy from. So it begins this copy. It tells the service, OK, start the copy of this blob. I've given it the lease ID, which I got from acquiring the lease on the destination blob as one of the conditions. And then the return, on return, I check if this copy has actually finished. Even though it was asynchronous, maybe it finished. So I'm going to check for its state. If the state is pending, what I'll do is I can monitor. Usually the monitoring can be done on a different thread so that this thread can go ahead and do and send the response back to your user. But on the monitoring thread, I can go and start monitoring for this, which is basically going to call, if you look at Fiddler, all it does is it does a fetch attribute on your blob to figure if this blob exists or not, or rather, if the copy has finished or not. And these are some of the new properties that we have started returning. It says, what is a copy ID, what is a copy source, copy status, and the progress for the copy. So all these is available to you. So this was a simple demo of how you can use analytics and also a new feature for copy blob. Future directions in some key areas. In the geo-replication area, some of the things that we want to provide are read from secondary. You have your secondary location today, but that is only meant, it's kind of a cold backup and only meant for geo disasters where we can go and fail over your account. With this particular feature, we will allow you, we'll give you another endpoint which you can use to now start reading from secondary. Consider the fact that geo-replication is done asynchronous, so there may be a lag, so it'll be eventually consistent on the secondary endpoint, but you can use it in scenarios where you don't mind looking at stale data if you don't want primary data always. So you can use that read from secondary also to validate your geo-replication, for example. The second feature that we would release is control your own failover. Today, we control the failover. However, we understand that for various compliance reasons or various testing-related scenarios for yourself, you may want to do this failover. So we will give you the ability to control the failover so where you can failover to your secondary site. The third thing which we will have then is SLA for geo-replication. We will give the RPO and RTO SLAs, basically a recovery point objective as to how fast or rather what's the delay or lag in the replication. That's your SLA for RPO. And RTO is the recovery time objective as to how soon your secondary can be up and running. We will also have the 1.8 library, client library. The new REST API that we've released today in our MSDN site is not available in the downloadable SDK. We have instead released source code, and it's available on GitHub. All the links are there in our blogs, so you'll have to use the source code from there. However, in 1.8, it'll be a first-class citizen of the SDK download. But we wanted to give that source code up front so that you don't have to wait for the 1.8 release. The other thing that we've heard you loud and clear is parity in storage emulator. Storage emulator is valuable for various reasons, for testing, or maybe you don't have internet access and you still want to code and figure out how your application is going to work. So the storage emulator, which is released with the SDK, will have better parity with cloud storage. Even with respect to cloud table today, though table is a NoSQL store, the dev emulator is built on SQL. So it will still have the parity, with some minor differences because of some limitations from SQL, but you will have parity, which you didn't have today. So with respect to resources, our team blogs, I would definitely recommend reading through the team blogs. It has scalability target. It has this SOSP paper as to how exactly the storage infrastructure works. In addition, the pricing information can be found in the pricing details page. Getting started has valuable getting started examples. The reason I didn't go over some of the getting started code is because I think this site does a better justice than what I could have done. Storage 171 can be retrieved from GitHub, the source code. You can build it and start using it. These are all the slides that I always have to put. Yeah, this is an important slide. Please let us know how the presentation went and what you want to learn more about so that next time we can concentrate on those topics. And this is the evaluation tag. Anybody questions?
A couple questions. One is the table storage. I heard you refer to it as a key value store, and I've always been confused as to whether it's a key value store, wide column, or both.
So it's key values store. As in, for a given key, you can have multiple values, columns basically, right? With name value pairs.
So that's not wide column then?
It is a wide column because the thing is your entities. You decide what columns that you need. So it's wide column in that aspect, right? But the thing that you shouldn't get confused with is it's not necessary that every entity will have the same columns. It's right. It's dynamic schema. So yes.
Right. Like Cassandra is wide column, and right. The paper from Brad references wide column.
Yes.
But I hear both, so I'm still confused. I'll ask you afterwards.
Yeah, it is a wide column in terms of the name value pairs because you can create.
Both.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think you nailed it there. And I had another question too. I'm curious about you mentioned that if it gets really hot on a blob, the Azure storage will notice this after a time and then divide across to.
So. It's not on a given blob, but it's on a given
range. Yeah. Or in a
container. Yeah. So it's a given range that you can think of. It could have multiple containers in it, but that given range, what our system does is monitors what the traffic demand is, and then we'll load balance so that we can meet that traffic demand.
So my specific question on that is, every time you see this talked about, it always splits it down the middle. But
no,
is
no,
it
no, no.
a much smarter, more?
Yeah, it is much smarter because I intentionally actually chose 0 to 200, though the range was 0999.
Oh, okay, I didn't pick up on that.
So, okay. Sorry, I should have been more explicit about that. Yeah, I didn't want to give this idea that it is always in the middle.
No, perfect.
It looks at where the traffic is concentrated and then splits it appropriately to meet the traffic.
Thank you.